Hello, I'm Michael.
Hello, I'm Linda.
And we are both art historians fascinated with the journey of the 18th century, 19th century grand tourists who went from the north of Italy, the north of Europe, down to the north of Italy, and then as far as Rome, which was the goal of their journey. But today we're going to make a little side trip from their main stopping point halfway through, if you like, which was at Florence, and we're on our way to Siena.
Yes, and Siena, oh, was one of the greatest, great, great, great towns of medieval Tuscany. And originally founded by the Etruscans in the 3rd century BC, it became a colony under Julius Caesar. When Attila the Hun was rampaging through Italy, he extracted a large tribute in exchange for bypassing the city with its troops. So it already in antiquity had a reputation for being a really grand and visitable city, if you like. And by the mid-13th century, Siena inflicted huge damage on the Florentines with a grand, great victory at the Battle of Montalperti in 1260. And that's such an important date, a seminal date in the history of the two cities, as it meant that Siena took the upper hand for a period of time, while Florence, it didn't really like this, was relegated to second place. As a result, Sienese art flourishes while Florence makes less headway, and it made a different kind of headway in the world of trade and commerce. And the tables turn eventually during the next centuries, and as one or the other city wins skirmish or battle.
I spent a week in Tuscany, as I mentioned in episode 8 of our podcast, The Grand Tour, with some 30 members of the Asian Patrons of the Vatican Museums, which is a group of philanthropists who sponsor the restoration and maintenance of artworks at the Vatican, in the museums, and in the Vatican in general. There are several international chapters, most of which really are in the United States, which support the arts of the Vatican Museums. The patrons were founded 40 years ago, almost 39 to be specific, and their purpose is to support the Holy See's efforts to preserve one of the oldest museums in the world. So after a week in Rome, viewing the artworks for which they'd paid and adopted for restoration, the patrons then spent a week between a vineyard in Borgo Luigi and a few days in Siena and Florence. And I must say it was wonderful to be able to travel again to Italy. And Italy itself has really picked up after a virtual lockdown in tourist terms for, I suppose, roughly 2 years. I was thinking of our grand tourists indeed and what challenges they faced. Despite the fact that the temperatures were up in the mid-30s when I was there with the patrons, at least we had the benefit of air conditioning and other conveniences. But if you look at the 18th century paintings, such as Canaletto's Vedute, which we spoke about a few episodes ago, you see how formally people were dressed, even in high summer. The ladies were decked out in ankle-length dresses in silk, cotton and linen, while the men were obliged to wear pretty heavy top coats and thigh-length waistcoats. And on top of that, they had to wear wigs. And on top of that, again, the men had to wear tri-cornered hats. So while we wore the lightest linen that we could find, my heart really went out to the grand tourists as they sweated their way along the road to Rome.
Yes, and of course, that road to Rome, the Via Aurelia Antica.
Yes, it's the road which ran from Rome northwards to the Alps and eventually connected to the north of Gaul, which is France in modern day terms, I suppose. It was dubbed the Via Francigena, the French way. And originally, although it was a Roman road which was made for the armies, during the medieval period it became a pilgrimage route which connected Canterbury, the shrine of St. Augustine and ultimately St. Thomas a Becket in the southeast of England, to Rome, at the heart of Italy.
Yes, and Siena itself is such a marvellous town. Could we say less developed than Florence in a way?
Yes, by all means, because that the reason for that was because in the overall scheme of things, Florence gradually won power over Siena and her territories. You mentioned a few moments ago the battles, they were coming and going and taking and losing territory all the time. But as a result, when Florence won the wars and battles, they were able to construct new buildings very much in the classical style of ancient Rome. And of course, that's why we call Florence the city of the Renaissance. While Siena then remained something of a backwater with its crooked medieval streets and Gothic arch buildings in high contrast with the grid plan of Florence. But yet Siena still has wonderful art.
And the grand tourists would have counted themselves very lucky if they'd arrived in Siena on the 2nd of July or indeed the 16th of August. These are 2 days on which a horse race takes place and took place around the Campo, which is a vast circular piazza which stands outside the old town hall. It's got the most wonderful city plan. It's rather like a kind of a U-shaped piazza, and it was called the Palio. So it was this wonderful, you know, kind of race that takes place within the city during this time, and this kind of festival. You can imagine the kind of heraldry. You can imagine this wonderful shaped square lined with supporters chanting and, you know, making all sorts of noise to do with which horse that they would want it to win. So a sort of a very early medieval kind of tradition which still takes place today.
Yes, we had an audience with Cardinal Lo Giudice, who's the Archbishop of Siena, and he very kindly brought us into his home, and we had a very interesting chat. But he was explaining that Siena's broken into different contradas or different sections, each of which supports a horse. And you're almost born into that contrada, and you have to stay with that for all your life. And it doesn't matter about what horses are on or off. And he even showed us recently a Polish artist had depicted the Blessed Virgin with a horse in her arms instead of the Christ child. So he said that was pretty disturbing for people. But anyway, it was just one way of showing how devoted these people are. But we went across after visiting the Cardinal to the hospice. Directly in front of his house is the hospice of Santa Maria della Scala, which was an old pilgrimage centre to receive pilgrims, but it doubled as a hospital, a hospice and an orphanage, or tripled, I should say. So anybody who's done the Camino of Santiago in Spain will be familiar with the joy of arriving in a hotel after a long afternoon. In the medieval period, people usually travelled by road, by foot. But in the time of the Grand Tourists, of course, in the 18th and 19th century, the majority of travellers used a coach or horse. And there's a fabulous, fascinating hall in the complex of Santa Maria della Scala, which stands right in front of the cathedral. Santa Maria served those purposes, but it was also an orphanage where children would have spent many, many, many years, and women would almost have spent the greatest part of their lives until they could be hopefully rescued with a dowry. The chapel itself contains a large number of magnificent frescoes which were painted in the middle of the 14th century. And according to a pious legend, in 1359, the hospice received a relic believed to have been a girdle used by the Virgin Mary. And the rector, to commemorate that, commissioned a new fresco from Bartolomeo Bartolini, whose life spanned most of the 14th century. And of course, this was only about 10 or 11 years after the Black Death had struck in 1348. So the bubonic plague was something which had such a decimating effect on the city. The large cycle of frescoes which we have in the Pilgrims' Hall is absolutely fascinating, and they're in a remarkably good state of preservation. And I should say they were restored a few years ago, but they give us, if you like, almost like a photograph into what life was like in the mid-15th century. They were painted by Domenico di Bartolo and his school. He was born around 1400 or so in Siena, and he depicted the history of the hospice. Now, according to legend, the hospice was founded by a local cobbler called Sorore in 898, although there's really no proof of that until about the 11th century. And then from that period onwards, the townspeople contributed to the enlargement of the complex, often leaving their lands and their territories and their goods in their wills for the support of the orphans. And the monumental frescoes in the Pilgrims' Hall are absolutely astonishing. they depict the foundation of the hospice and the work that went on minding the children and their mothers, as well as tending to the weary pilgrims who filed through the halls each day on their way from Rome. My favourite panel is one showing a young man being tended to by a surgeon, although perhaps surgeon is too grand a title, but the man kneeling in front of My favourite panel is one showing a young man being tended to by a surgeon, although perhaps surgeon is too grand a title, but the man who's kneeling in front of the injured young man whose leg is pouring blood is identified as a surgeon by his red hat.
Ah, so, and well, across, as you say, across from here, and you mentioned the cathedral, we really have to consider this. The facade of the cathedral is probably one of the best known in Italy. It's always kind of called out as being this extraordinary kind of extravaganza, this extraordinary event, if you like, in terms of cathedral architecture. In fact, it was a medieval church. It's a Marian church dedicated to the Assumption of Mary. It was the episcopal seat of the Diocese of Siena, and from the 15th century, that of the Archdiocese of Siena, and the seat, as you mentioned, of Siena Colle di Valle del Montalcino. So all of those things gathered together. So very powerful indeed, and overlooking the parishes and the diocese and these territories in this region since the 15th century. So a lot of affiliation with that, as Michael has said. The cathedral itself was designed and completed between 1215 and 1263. And as we noted earlier, this was during the period of Siena on the ascent, or, you know, when it's feeling very kind of confident and building and showcasing itself as this new territorial kind of power in the region. It's on the site of an earlier structure, and of course in the form of a great Basilican kind of Latin cross. There is a transept, there's a dome and a bell tower, and the dome rises from this very interesting, it's kind of hexagonal base. There are supporting columns, and was completed in 1264. So again, extraordinary in terms of the advances being made in terms of these architecture and these domes, these duomos are the name being given to these kind of great cathedrals, these great central churches in this part of Italy. Interesting too is that the lantern atop the dome was added by none other than the great Baroque architect Gian Lorenzo Bernini, who is also works we will come to when we look at Rome and look at his great armature that he placed around and forefronting the great St. Peter's San Pietro. In any case, also the colours of the cathedral, it's black and white, and these were symbolic colours of Siena, also said to be linked to the black and white horses of the legendary city's founders, Senius and Ascesius. Also, in fact, there are several other adorning the facade, many sculptures and different artists featured, and also different sculptors' hands at work, apart from Bernini, Pinturicchio, Donatello, Giovanni Pisano, Niccolò Pisano, and of course Lorenzo Ghiberti. And we're going to turn to their hands and look at some of their work in the great city of Florence in forthcoming episodes. So hold on to those ideas of those artists. The facade then of the cathedral, its work, which was overseen by Giovanni Pisano, it's extremely impressive. And the main kind of entrance to the Duomo, there are three great portals. And in fact, what would we think of it in terms of style? How would we characterize it? Is there a Tuscan Romanesque? There certainly is. There is French Gothic, which doesn't really make itself felt across the Alps in many respects. And there's also classical architecture. So it's a combination of all those elements. And work began on the lowest part around 1284. It is this wonderful polychrome, this wonderful stripy effect. And Giovanni and his father, Niccolò Pisano, worked together on this. And in many respects, horizontal, the kind of emphasis of this sort of stripy effect. You see it also in Orvieto. You also see it in many of the churches in Florence itself. So we'll be visiting some of those choose and considering that theme of polychrome, of colour in due course.
Well, one of the places that I would say is worth going to see before we leave is the Piccolomini Library, which is a magnificent library, which is decorated by some of the great artists of the period. And the young Raphael, we know, worked on this. He was under the tutelage, if you like, of Pinturicchio. But unfortunately, there just isn't time to do everything on our grand tour. Wish there was, but let's say ciao and arrivederci till the next time when we return for the day to Florence.
That's right. And thank you, Michael. Exactly. You always have to leave something over for the next time. Arrivederci and ciao.